This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, so you know the rules of writing. Some alliteration is good, a lot of it is bad. But when you think about all the news we've had this week, you'll see why I just can't help it. Because today there was Paul Levy. Then there were stories on probation, parole, politics, and Patrick, as in Governor Deval Patrick and his second term. So first, that parole board. Calls rang out for board members to resign or at least suspend hearings after the shooting death of a Woburn police officer, allegedly by a repeat violent offender, out on parole. Chased by cameras and microphones, the head of the State Parole Department, Mark Conrad, offered a public apology to the officer's family.
I just want to lend my heart and my special regards and my sympathy out to the McGuire family.
But heartfelt sympathy just wasn't enough this week for House Minority Whip Brad Hill of Ipswich.
For too long, we have seen these violent criminals on the streets of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts continue to commit crime after crime after crime.
John McGuire was the Woburn officer who was killed by that alleged repeat offender. And when talking about crime, one person heading into prison soon is former state senator Diane Wilkerson. She received a 42-month sentence on a corruption conviction. All this in the same week politics kicks off again on Beacon Hill with the launch of Governor Deval Patrick's second term.
We will file legislation in the coming weeks to address health care costs, including significant payment reform and simplification. This will be a challenge. There will be great debate and resistance to change.
To discuss what kind of resistance the governor may face in his new term and to wrestle with other battles brewing on Beacon Hill, we're joined by our Friday News in Review team, Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Renee.
Thank you.
And also with us is Craig Sandler of the State House News Service. Hi there, Craig.
Hi, Meghna.
There's also big news in housing today, and we'll get to that in a bit. But listeners, what was your top story of the week? Are you hoping that the parole board resigns over the release of Dominic Cinelli, the man who allegedly shot the Woburn police officer? Do you think it was fair to sentence Diane Wilkerson to 3.5 years? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment online at wbur.org/Boston. So, Renee Loth, let's just start with the governor's inaugural speech. What did you make of it?
Well, I thought it was a vigorous speech and ambitious. I think that Governor Patrick, as you heard in that little clip, is looking forward to putting the lie to the idea that he's a lame duck. He's said that he's not running for yet another term, but he does have 4 years to get things accomplished, and he doesn't want people writing him off so quickly. There was one point in the speech in which he said, being first in the nation on education achievement is nice, but we're on our way to being first in the world. You know, it was like, whoa. So I think he's trying to project a sense of energy and ambition in the context of being his last term.
And in the context of a $1.8 billion budget gap, Craig.
Otherwise known as Debbie Downer, right? But that's right. And then I think to some degree, by striking such a positive and energetic and vigorous tone, he may have been out to set himself up to work really well with the other players. This is going to be a really difficult year, and he did not want to start out on the foot, with rhetoric about changing the climate, particularly given what the climate is ethically up there, or doing battle with the people he's going to have to do really hard work with very soon.
Craig, I mean, Renee said that she found it to be a very, ambitious and invigorating speech. Did you feel the same way? Because I know some other people felt that it wasn't quite as soaring as it was 4 years ago in his first inaugural.
Well, I think there's some inevitability about that. That was a really special moment. Frankly, if there's something special about this moment, it was how mundane it was to be swearing in a black governor. That was really wonderful in its own right, never mind being sworn in by a woman, the first woman ever to swear in a governor in Massachusetts. It's not for me to say whether it was soaring enough necessarily. I think that he had a lot of opportunity to strike negative tones and didn't do it. And the one thing that people in the building are talking about is, given the ambition of the speech, what is he up to is the wrong way. What is he after? Why is he being so bold?
Renee?
Yeah, I just would say that 4 years ago, the speech was much more idealistic, meeting the moment, the historic moment at the time. This speech was more realistic, more tempered by the realities that Craig is talking about. You know, but I still think that it was really rather upbeat. You know,
sure.
There was a lot of sort of victory lap and
generational responsibility. I mean, a big speech and also with a specific agenda with big goals.
Actually, Renee, I was just going to ask you about that. I mean, what do you think he has the governor has potentially to gain and possibly to lose by taking on health care? Such a huge issue right off the bat here.
I mean, as his friend President Barack Obama has learned, you know, being focused on health care can really distract you from a lot of different issues, and it is a risk. It's a very difficult, you know, devilishly difficult, complex issue, and it's expensive, and nobody's ever happy, and it's really, you know, risky. But I think it's bankrupting the state, and I think that he has to take it on, and you know, of course, also Massachusetts being the first in the nation to have a health care reform law needs to be the model for the country, and there's a lot riding on it.
So it is easier, actually, for him to marshal the resources and the personalities around the objective of let's make this work. In Obama's case, you know, they were trying to institute something unprecedented and historic. The mission here is to not have a historic effort go off the rails.
Let's move on to the controversy with the parole board and the shooting of the Woburn police officer, John McGuire. Republicans are calling for a change on the board, and a bipartisan group is introducing legislation yet again that could call for tighter restrictions on parolees and is demanding that the board suspend all parole hearings until the governor has had a chance to complete an ongoing investigation. Some folks are even calling for the members of the board to resign. So, I mean, is this something that could be once again one of those Massachusetts controversies that just dogs all action on Beacon Hill for some time? Renee Loth.
Well, I will say this. I think it's a good idea to suspend parole hearings for the time being, or parole decisions, because it will be impossible to have a fair hearing in this political atmosphere. You know, you could be the most the best parolee candidate, and you wouldn't get a fair hearing right now. So I think it's a good idea to suspend the hearings. You know, the problem is that thousands of people are paroled every year, and you do get the occasional tragedy, and it's just a terrible tragedy. But you cannot keep these people in prison forever. 97% of the prison population will eventually be paroled, and you know, you need to be able to have systems that function, and they can't function in this kind of atmosphere.
Well, you mentioned systems that function, and you know, it's been brought to my attention, Craig, that you know, you've got this issue of parole and how parolees are dealt with, and then you have the probation department as well. So you've got that's also falling apart more or less, and so you've got this entire system of criminal justice in Massachusetts from top to tail almost in need of dire need of attention.
Yeah, it sounds like such a mishmash, you know, to the public ear and to the public mind. It absolutely sounds like one big lump, even though it really isn't. Those are two very different things, both of which I would say the probation department reforms have to be dealt with. It is true. The parole situation is more acute, but it's kind of it's the issue of the moment. And I think that those issues, as with DSS or Department of Children and Families, you know, the child welfare agencies, those things come and go. I don't mean to say that callously at all. Having said that, I think that we probably will not see quick action on Melissa's Law, which is the law that would ban parole for repeat violent offenders, which would be the natural solution or attempted solution, and has been languishing for 10 years. The measure of whether it's really taking all the oxygen out of the halls of government is how quickly they feel compelled to act on Melissa's Law, and I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Let's get one quick call in here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We are talking about the week in news, this first week of January 2011. Bob is calling from Hingham. Welcome to Radio Boston, Bob.
Good afternoon, Magna. I just want to speak briefly about the tragedy of the parole board. This guy had 3 life sentences, criminal for most of his life. There's no way he should have been on the streets. And these members, I'm sure that they feel regret and whatever, but I don't care if this is job security or what, they must resign. I don't know how they would be removed, but they must resign. Their job is to read between the lines. They can't guess it. It's a man's life tragically lost in the line of duty, and they must resign. They can figure out how to revamp the system later on, because I don't think there's going to be too many paroles looked at for a while, but I don't see how they can be valid in their position at this time.
Bob, thank you so much for your call. Renee Loth, you hear the passion there, and I'm sure a lot of people feel it as well. I wonder, the parole board is made up of gubernatorial appointees from both sides of the aisle, so could this be something that dogs not only Governor Patrick, but his predecessor, Governor Romney?
Well, I'm pretty sure that not all the members of the parole board that are sitting now voted on this particular Sinelli's parole.
That's right.
So, you know, they must all resign. Well, a couple of them were not even voting on the parole. So, you know, I think it's a, you know, bipartisan tragedy and a bipartisan problem for any governor. You know, just as Craig said, there are certain agencies in government, child welfare is another one,
yep,
where there are awful tragedies and there's a sudden interest and focus on reforming the bureaucracy or the people at the top or whatever.
No,
and, you know, these
never happen again.
Yeah, you know, these are systemic problems. I'm not minimizing. It's a terrible thing. But I don't think that necessarily just getting the entire board to resign will be a solution.
Craig?
I think that Bob represents the people. I think that people do want this batch to resign, which would hardly be the end of the system or the end of the world. Maybe appropriate. I thought that the governor, perhaps, you know, he still will display a tenure from time to time. And I think that perhaps in talking about a go slow approach and kind of wandering into talking about what a tragedy the shooting was a case of not really getting it right, because if it is a tragedy, Governor, then we want you to express our outrage, we the people, our outrage about the system that allowed it to happen. All he's got to do is express it and then say in due course we'll address it. But he didn't really express the outrage people are feeling. Leaders are most effective when they do express the emotions of the people at moments like that.
Well, we've heard emotion expressed from another leader, but maybe her own emotions this week, Diane Wilkerson.
Man,
I want to touch on that story briefly before we run out of time here, because she was sentenced just yesterday to 42 months in prison for taking bribes during her time in office. And here she is after receiving her sentence.
What I would submit to you today is that the very effort by the local and federal law enforcement to accomplish their goal was in itself a most corrupt and outrageous abuse of the justice system. I've been through it before, and I'll get through this stronger and with my head held high.
Renee Loth, you know, one issue that's been brought up, and Diane Wilkerson brought it up herself, but that other Massachusetts politicians who have been convicted of various corruption charges did not spend a day in jail.
Well, in fact, I mean, it was, you know, timing is everything. And not to minimize what Diane Wilkerson, you know, agreed that she admitted she did, she was not helped in the sentencing by the appearance of two convicted ex-speakers and one indicted ex-speaker on the front page of the Boston Globe that morning.
Christopher, you know, the prosecutor, quite literally.
Quite literally being, you know, hailed as returning prodigal sons who, you know, were also convicted of federal crimes and who did not serve time in jail.
But should she be punished for the lack of punishment for other folks? I mean, that's kind of the question.
A question,
I should say.
You know, the answer is probably not, but that is the reality, for one thing. For another thing, these are very serious violations of the public trust. Don't forget, when the public sees someone stuffing money into their undergarments on the front page, that does a lot more damage to a lot more people and our institutions than might have been done to Diane Wilkerson by having to serve an extra 10 months.
It is always such a roller coaster in Massachusetts politics. We'll have so much to talk about this year. It's actually kind of exciting. We've just got a couple minutes to go, and as we do every week, our hubbubs of the news that didn't make it to this table but worth talking about. Renee Loth?
Well, the first media fad of 2011, mysterious bird die-offs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I love birds. It's really sad to see their little bodies, but, you know, these things happen all the time.
The 5,000 birds dropping out of the
sky?
There
were something like 90 bird die-offs recorded by the U.S. Geological Survey last 6 months of the year. And, you know, but of course, now this is a media contagion. And, you know, everywhere you turn, they're being reported. You know, they're in Sweden and Louisiana and Arkansas and, you know, Australia and Japan. And, you know, you could be excused for being really alarmed. But I really really think it's just kind of a media fad.
It's the shark attacks of 2010.
Shark attacks of 2011, yes.
Greg, you're above.
2011, exactly. I guess, well, it's obvious to everyone at this momentous juncture in the setting of our public policy in Massachusetts, we all must hail the passage of the Pet Trust Fund Bill, which allows the good citizens.
The Leona Helmsleys of Massachusetts are glad to hear this.
For your pet birds.
The troubles of Massachusetts, that's it, precisely. Well, you know, in my case, your pet rabbits. I really do have a mental image of my rabbit, you know, lounging in her new golden cage after I depart this veil. my media empire. But in any case, you know, there's a lot of people out there who actually will quite literally die happy knowing that their money that is intended for the Fluffies and Boots of this world are going to be there for their pets when their owners are in the next world.
Craig, you always make it difficult for me to follow up, but this week I actually have a hubbub that is so serious and so important, truly, that I have brought in WBUR's business and technology reporter, Kurt Nikisch, to give it for us. Kurt, tell us the news.
Well, today the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court basically upheld a ruling that came out in fall of 2009. So this isn't news, but it really puts an exclamation point on it. And basically they're saying that a lot of foreclosures that happened in Massachusetts didn't happen for the right reasons and that they weren't documented well. And it throws a bunch of those into question. It means it's going to be kind of messy going forward. There may be people who bought a house that had been foreclosed on. They've moved in. And now the original owner may get it back. They may have to move out.
Yeah, so these are potentially thousands of homeowners who, because of paperwork glitches, will not be losing their homes immediately, at least?
A lot of the folks in the industry thought they were following best practices, and the judge in the original ruling said, you know, you haven't been following it. And so a lot of innocent people in the industry, a lot of innocent people who were foreclosed on, a lot of innocent people who moved in are all going to be affected. It's going to be a case-by-case basis going forward. There are ways around it. And I guess some of the disappointment maybe in today's ruling is that there isn't enough guidance from the state's highest court going forward how to solve, you know, this mess that's out there.
Is there any possibility that the SJC's ruling could have an effect nationally in other states where people are also wondering, did paperwork make my foreclosure null and void?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that this basically gives a little more a little more ammunition for people who want to make a case. This, you know, all that no-doc robo-signing stuff that you heard about, this happened early enough that the industry corrected the problem, you know, from 2009 forward. It's going back. So it'll help the national industry, but it's not exactly the same. It's not exactly the same problem.
WBUR's business and technology reporter, Kurt Nikisch, thank you so much. Craig Sandler of State House News, thank you as well. And Renee Loth with the Boston Globe, thank you. All of you have a
Happy
wonderful weekend.
Year.